Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Scientists say it's going to take a lot of cutbacks in our carbon dioxide emissions to spare the world deeply destructive climate change. Last week, they said it's also going to take more than that. We're going to have to sweep CO2 out of the atmosphere, clean it up, not just stop putting it in. And if we wait too long, the cost of doing that could crush us. This hour on Point, sweeping up CO2. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on Can You Picture It? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today from New York is James Hansen. He's been called the father of climate change awareness. He and others published a paper last week in the Journal of Earth System Dynamics with a team of international researchers which found we need to start removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, not just slow down the rate at which it's being put in. You can link to that study at onpointradio.org. Jim Hansen is a professor at Columbia University's Earth Institute, directs the program in there in climate science, awareness and solutions, and he's former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Jim Hansen, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you again.
So we understand that there's been a lot of concern for a long time that we slow down the rate of emission of CO2. You say it's only going to take more than just slowing the rate. Like what?
Yeah. Unfortunately, because we have not slowed the rate, we've now reached a point where we will guarantee young people a situation with climate out of their control unless we phase down emissions rapidly and also take some of the excess CO2 out of the atmosphere. We can do a lot of that with quasi-natural processes, you know, storing more carbon in the soil and in the biosphere, in the forests. But we've now reached a point where the amount that we need to take out is larger than we estimate is possible with those quasi-natural ways of doing it.
Can you describe the quasi-natural ways, as you say? What are you talking about? Planting more forests? Or what do you mean soil? How does soil
work? Yeah, actually the biggest term in this would be reforestation of some marginal lands that are not needed for agriculture. But just, improved agricultural practices means stop plowing up the soil in a way that causes it to release carbon to the atmosphere. You can actually make the soil more productive with other techniques, minimum till agriculture, for example.
So you say no-till or low-till agriculture,
yeah.
How does that help with CO2? Does soil actually pull CO2 out of the atmosphere, or are you just talking about less release?
It does pull it out, especially soil that you've damaged by releasing a lot of the carbon. There's actually more carbon in the soil than there is in the atmosphere. It's a big reservoir, and we've decreased the size of that with the way that we've treated the soil. But we can restore that. I'm not particularly an expert on that. I have as co-authors on this paper mm-hmm. some of the best experts in the world in relevant subjects, including that one.
If reforestation and tending to our soil, and we'll talk more about that with people who really know how that works, if those are no longer enough, in addition to dramatically cutting emissions, what's the further option for taking CO2 out of the atmosphere? How do you do it? I mean, a butterfly net won't do it.
Well, there are many candidates for that. One that IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has put the greatest emphasis on is burning biofuels in power plants and capturing the CO2 and then storing it underground. that's going to be pretty expensive. But in fact, all of the methods that have been talked about seem to be pretty expensive. But another one is speeding up the weathering process. That, you know, if you spread rock dust in agricultural areas or areas where you're growing trees, you can increase the productivity, but also speed up the weathering process so that the chemical reactions of the water in the streams and going to the ocean will speed up the rate at which you're storing limestone on the floor of the ocean. And that, again, is a natural process, but you could speed it up. So that's another candidate. Other people talk about having machines, you know, that just suck the CO2 out, and then you use it to either make bricks or store the CO2 underground. But again, it's probably very expensive.
The number $500 trillion comes up here for CO2.
Yeah, that's expensive.
That's a totally mind-boggling number. What kind of activity would cost that much? Is that the sort of scenario, science kind of fiction scenario of giant machines that suck CO2 out of the atmosphere?
Well, yeah, that's the worst case where we stay on high fossil fuel emissions. And by the way, what we hope people will take from this paper is not that we're recommending development of these machines. What we're recommending is, hey, let's start to reduce emissions rapidly so we can minimize the requirements for sucking the CO2 out of the atmosphere. If we do that, then those quasi-natural processes may be the main thing that we need.
Is that dollar figure part of why you've put out this paper? There's this lawsuit in Oregon brought by a bunch of young Americans saying that the cost of the government inaction on climate change is going to fall on them. And I think your granddaughter is one of the 21 plaintiffs in this lawsuit, which at this point is still going ahead. Does your paper give them a dollar figure to work with to say this is what will fall on us, the cost will fall on us if we don't act more aggressively to steer off climate change?
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about the lawsuit in our paper. This paper was written to provide some of the science to support that lawsuit, and that's why I ask all these international scientific leaders to be co-authors so that it would have authority. It's actually the second paper. We had published one earlier in 2013, which included other experts in economics, human health, species extinction, coral reefs. There are a lot of climate impacts if we stay on business as usual with fossil fuel emissions. But it looks like the biggest one, the one that where we really could leave a situation for young people that's out of their control, is the stability of the ice sheets and the impact that decay of these ice sheets would have on sea level. If we don't get on a different path of emissions pretty quickly, we're going to guarantee that there will be multi-meter sea level rise on a time scale that we've estimated would be 50 to 150 years. And that would have consequences that are just hard to imagine, because more than half of the large cities in the world are located on coastlines. And if you get multi-meter sea level rise, most of those cities will become dysfunctional. The economic consequences and the human migration issue that would be associated with that is mind-boggling. So we really can't let that happen. But to avoid it, we've got to start reducing emissions.
You told the Oregon court that the suicidal nature of U.S. climate and energy policy makes this lawsuit necessary. What's suicidal in your view?
Well, it's suicidal if you allow the process that I just mentioned ice sheets to go unstable and sea level to begin rising. Because once that process starts, you won't be able to stop that. And as I said, civilization established most of its large cities on coastlines. So we have a very vulnerable situation. I mean, look at the number of migrants we have now. Compare that to what it would be if we let a sea level rise some meters. It would dwarf the number that we have now. It's hard to imagine that the planet would be governable if we let that happen.
And you're not just talking about distant cities here. I guess you're talking about American migrants as well.
Sure. Yeah, we have New York, Boston, Washington, Miami. We've got a lot of large cities on the coastline which are very vulnerable. Look at the relatively small sea level effect of the storm Sandy that hit New York a few years ago. That's minor compared to what would happen if we let ice sheets go unstable.
We're going to come back and look at what negative carbon emissions or cleaning up CO2 from the atmosphere would mean. Are you talking large-scale action on this in the U.S.? Or, I mean, we've got a lot of reforestation that's happened here already, I think. Is it most of this activity, would it be abroad, Jim Hansen?
Well, yeah, but the United States is responsible for more than a quarter of the excess CO2 in the atmosphere. So we've got a huge debt. We're the biggest contributors to the climate problem.
Of course, we're out of the Paris Climate Accord. Can you see this, the U.S. still delivering on what were its promises under that accord?
Well, that accord was not a solution anyhow. I mean, the fundamental problem is that fossil fuels are allowed to be the cheapest form of energy. That's because they're partially subsidized and they don't have to pay their cost to society. So what we really need is an agreement to have a rising carbon fee. And if we would do that in the United States, we could make it global.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Before we get back to the show, I wanted to tell you to be sure and stay with us till the very end of this podcast for a preview of Freak Out and Carry On. It's WBUR's new podcast that addresses today's politics through a historical lens. Give it a listen, and thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the race against rising CO2 levels in the atmosphere and the new warning that slowing emissions is no longer enough, that we're going to have to suck carbon dioxide, CO2, out of the skies, out of the atmosphere. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Are you ready to hear that we're going to have to stop polluting and then some, that we're going to have to actively take measures to draw down CO2 levels in the atmosphere? Are you ready to plant more trees, sprinkle iron, limestone on the ocean floors, invest in CO2 removal machinery? Can you even picture that? James Hansen is with us, so-called father of climate change awareness. He's now at Columbia University's Earth Institute, was former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, joins us from New York. With us right now as well from the other coast, San Diego, California, is John O'Niles, director of the Carbon Institute, which works with universities and governments around the world to measure and manage carbon dioxide. The Institute helped coordinate scientific strategy for more than a dozen nations leading up to the Paris Agreement. And John O'Niles joins us right now from San Diego. Mr. Niles, thanks a lot for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Let me play a couple pieces of tape for you, if I may. And the first one is our President Trump. This was June 1st, is announcing his decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord in Washington.
I am fighting every day for the great people of this country. Therefore, in order to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens. The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
The President of the United States on June 1st of this year. So there's one poll, John Niles. And here's another. This is into the CO2 removal front. This is from a Swiss firm named Climeworks. They recently became the first of its kind to commercialize a product sucking carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And here's an ad released by the company just before, not long before the president's announcement there. This is CEO, co-founder of Climeworks. This is Jan Wurzbacher talking about the company's goal to capture 1% of annual CO2 emissions by 2025.
It is our vision to capture 1% of global CO2 emissions in 2025. To capture 1% of global emissions, we would need to install around 750,000 shipping containers filled with CO2 collectors. And this is the amount of shipping containers that pass through Shanghai Harbor in 2 weeks. This is something that global economy can manage.
Okay, John Niles. Well, you know, it is just head spinning sometimes. On the one hand, you've got the U.S. president pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. Okay. The other hand, we've got somebody here in Switzerland talking about putting 750,000 shipping containers with CO2 collectors around the world to pull carbon dioxide or 1% of our annual emissions out of the atmosphere. Is that what it's going to take, John Niles?
Well, the starting point for all this, of course, is the Paris Agreement is the largest source of consensus in human history. So we had every country come together and agree how to move forward with this long-term problem. So there's really a stepwise approach. The first thing is, as Jim and you noted, we need to reduce emissions. We need to pull as much carbon out of the atmosphere with natural systems. We're going to have to adapt as some of the consequences you've talked about. And Jim, the world will see continued sea level rises, coral bleaching, more extreme events. And then, you know, given that we've continued to not deal with this problem directly, we may have to think about geoengineering solutions. Some of these machines or other systems that are still in their infancy, but we may need them.
Jim says Paris is not enough. So that the study that came out last week says, you know, even with the efforts that are currently on the table, we're going to have to take steps to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere. How much of that, in your view, can be done with what James Hansen's calling quasi-natural techniques, you know, reforestation and soil management? And what portion may have to be this kind of active, almost mechanical geoengineering?
Well, the biggest thing we can do, of course, is to stop cutting forests and to replant forests on hundreds of millions of acres that we've already degraded. So those have a lot of co-benefits for people who live in those communities and plants and animals and water supplies. So these are no-brainer solutions. The Paris Agreement, I would differ a little bit with Jim. It was a major solution. Every country agreed to the targets and to how we're going to get there. We have to measure each country's emissions, and then countries make pledges, and then we see if they're meeting those pledges. So I do think it's an extremely important solution. It's how the world should solve problems, coming together and doing this. In terms of the geoengineering and some of the high-tech solutions, I think it's safe to say that everyone who studies this thinks we should be taking a look at these, but they still are extremely expensive. And they're not ready to deploy yet. So there's a lot of other stuff we can do in the meantime.
$500 trillion sounds impossible as a figure to spend. On the other hand, I don't know, the fate of the planet on the line. In terms of reforestation, where's the needle moving? I mean, we watch the forests come down in Borneo, in Brazil, the Amazon basin. Are we gaining on forestation or still losing globally?
Globally, we're still losing millions of acres per year, but there's a lot of good news as well. We've seen Brazil, which was the largest deforester, their rate of deforestation come down significantly if you look at the trend lines. There's a lot of activity trying to plant hundreds of millions of acres of degraded lands. 21 countries in Africa have committed themselves to doing this with funding. It's not just governments either. We see some of the biggest corporations in the world who are saying we are going to commit ourselves and hold ourselves accountable to source all of our materials from areas that haven't cut down trees and degraded the lands.
But still, net losses on that front. What about Jim Hansen was talking about seeding the ocean floor with limestone, iron? What is it? How would that work? How might that increase the absorption of CO2?
Well, there's a whole range of processes. There's ways we can, yes, fertilize the ocean and suck more CO2 out. There's all sorts of solutions that you can run air across and it grabs the CO2, as was mentioned. But the key thing, Tom, really at this point is that these are far out of reach. When you talk about $500 trillion, people can't even fathom that. And we do know that when you have a solution with, you know, a cost of such magnitude, that people become a little bit apathetic. So I'm a bit more optimistic in that we need to get governments measuring carbon, holding themselves accountable, and then innovating and creating jobs so that we can reduce these emissions.
I'm sorry, I didn't really understand what you had to say about how it would work on the ocean floor. Can you describe to us materially how that would work and what difference it might make? I understand you want an optimistic take on this, and that's great. But we also want a solution. Let's hear it.
Well, there's Jim?
Tom, I think we're talking about two different things there. I was referring to speeding up the weathering process, and that is not spreading something on the ocean usually. It's on in agricultural or even in forests where you spread finely ground rock dust to actually improve the fertility and the productivity of the soil, but it ends up eventually speeding up the weathering process, which means you'll end up putting more limestone on the floor of the ocean.
All right. Is there also something here that I'm talking about iron on the floor of the ocean, John, Jim?
Iron fertilization of the ocean is a different suggested way to get CO2 out of the air.
John, can you explain it?
Yeah, Tom. Well, as we've talked about, you could sprinkle iron across the ocean, and then through chemical reactions, it draws down CO2 and drops it towards the bottom of the ocean. That's one of these geoengineering approaches. Jim's described some others. You can also take carbonated water and inject it into basalt, and it reacts with calcium and magnesium and ends up being out of the atmosphere and stored in rocks. So there's a range of these technologies that are being explored right now. Most of them are very expensive.
And technically, when we hear the guy in Switzerland talking about putting 750,000 shipping containers around the world, sucking CO2 out of the air, what's that process like? What happens there?
The key challenge, of course, is CO2 is extremely dilute. When we talk about 400 parts per million, you have to grab these molecules out of the air and condense them and put them in a place where they're not in the atmosphere and they're not going to escape back into the atmosphere. So I don't know the particular technology that he's exploring right now, the speaker, the clip that you had on earlier. But most people are pretty skeptical. We've heard a lot of these exciting ideas that could draw down CO2. We haven't seen any of them go to scale at a cost that's even fathomable.
And $500 trillion is nearly unfathomable. Calls for the two of you. Tom in Burlington, Wisconsin. Tom, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
We had a flood here in Burlington, 18 feet above sea level. Above normal river level last week. I'm in Paul Ryan's district. He's the Speaker of the House of Representatives. He came over here and gave a big wave and left town. And what I would like to see is we need a full investigation on flooding, just on flooding. Get everybody together. We found out that the railroad is creating some of the problem. When the water gets on the other side of the railroad and goes down a mile, it tries to get back into the dam, but it can't because the railroad prevents it from doing so. So we've got to kind of coordinate that thing. There were no sirens around here. I was sitting having my my butter cookies, dunking it in milk at the river, and the water came up to my ankles, and then I had to get out of there. And then now I have to go and throw away my mattress and throw away my carpeting because we've got mud, we've got mold. Mold is a big problem here.
Yeah.
It might come in first month or a year later. So So,
Tom, we got it. We want you to stay high and dry. It's hard if the water goes up 18 feet. I don't know about the details of that. But James Hansen, it's not just the coast we're talking about when it comes to extreme weather events and
well, that's right. Yeah. Well, that's what we said decades ago, that as the atmosphere gets warmer, it holds more water vapor. So you get the possibility of greater rainfall and greater floods. And if you look statistically, that's what's happening. You also get the more extreme droughts because of the higher temperature. So we get greater on both ends of the hydrologic cycle, greater extremes.
Let's go to Terry in Springfield, Ohio. Terry, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I have to start by saying I'm in complete sympathy with your guests' objectives here. I believe that global warming is something that needs to be dealt with sooner rather than later. However, I just want to bring up a minute point that he was talking about a few minutes back. He was talking about changing agricultural methods away from plowing and using more no-till techniques. And I have a little knowledge, very little, but you know, I believe that that requires a lot more herbicide and fertilizer to make the agriculture successful. And the regional problem here in the Great Lakes region is that this is causing runoff, chemical runoff that goes into creeks and into rivers and into Great Lakes and inland lakes, and causing really increasingly nasty algae blooms, which are a regional ecological disaster.
So maybe less soil runoff, but more chemical runoff is what you're concerned about, Terry?
Exactly.
John Niles, do you follow that? If we try and have the soil capturing more of this with low-till agriculture, what about the, you know, there's a cost to everything.
Yeah, he raises a good point. Often when we switch to different agricultural methods, there's a couple years that are pretty hard to maintain productivity or increase productivity without some other interventions such as, you know, additional chemicals. Generally, after a couple years, though, of enhanced practices, we do see a rebound back to original or higher levels of productivity without those chemical inputs. But he was right. There's often a trade-off in the very short term.
Jim, I'm curious that you and John seem to have a different take on Paris. I mean, you say very plainly it's not enough. John, you know, says, well, it's the best we've ever done, and it's our best hope.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think we do need to discuss that. I'm not saying that Paris, that getting governments to say climate is a problem is not an accomplishment, but it's not going to really lead to solving the problem by itself. If we don't recognize that as long as we let fossil fuels be the cheapest energy, someone's going to keep burning those. So just having a goal to reduce your emissions isn't good enough. We have to understand that we have to make the price of fossil fuels honest. We have to begin to include in their price the cost to society. That's the fundamental thing that's needed.
I mean, you say have to, but obviously we just heard the president there saying no even to the Paris Accord. I mean, you know, nobody has to do anything apparently.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's so important. There's an organization, Citizens Climate Lobby, which understands this and which is it's a growing organization now, more than 300 chapters in the United States and more than 50,000 members. And they are very effective in that they're very polite. They visit their congresspeople, their senators and representatives, and they argue that we need to have this rising carbon fee. And they've commissioned economic studies that show if you do this, if you collect a fee from the fossil fuel companies, distribute all of the money to the public, an equal amount to all legal residents, it actually spurs the economy. Increases the GNP and creates millions of jobs. So it's not a costly thing. In fact, it's economically beneficial. But we can't get our governments to do that because they're just too much in bed with the fossil fuel industry.
Hard to get action on a lot of fronts. Paris happening, of course, even there, John, that requires that depends on companies upping their commitment over the years. On the negative carbon emissions, do you see people taking affirmative steps to increase this sort of CO2 capture out of the atmosphere? Or is that off in the realm of studies?
Could you repeat that again, Tom?
Well, are people taking comparable steps to reducing emissions when it comes to removing CO2 that's already there from the atmosphere?
Yeah, well, let me back it up a little bit. The way Paris works is countries make a commitment, then they measure their inventories, and we see if they're on track. And that's a whole range of activities that each country is going to decide for itself. So they can regulate coal plants, which we tried to do under the Obama administration. They also have the right to explore these other technologies where they can suck CO2 out of the air if that's in their national interest.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a new report out last week that cutting back on CO2, carbon dioxide emissions, is no longer enough. A lot of that is required, but that to stay ahead of environmental or climate, very destructive climate change, we're going to have to actually take CO2 out of the atmosphere. We can do that with forests. Yes, we can do that with soil. The ocean has a capacity for some of that, but we're still losing millions of acres of forest every year. And much more may need to be done on both sides. Jim Hansen was an author on that study. He's been called the father of climate change awareness. He's at Columbia University's Earth Institute, and with us today from New York, John Niles is director of the Carbon Institute, focused on all the problems we're having with carbon dioxide when it comes to our atmosphere. He joins us today from San Diego. You can join us this hour as well. Will we be better at removing CO2 from the atmosphere than we've been at cutting back emissions? And who's going to take the lead on this with the Trump administration in Washington? How does this get done, or does it get done? Al Gore's got a new movie coming out about all this, an Inconvenient Sequel, it's called. He was talking with NPR's Morning Edition today, saying that extreme weather events with climate change are becoming more common, and Mother Nature sort of having the last word here, maybe more persuasive than scientists.
Here in the U.S., we've had 11 once-in-a-thousand-year events in just 7 years, in the last 7 years. Last year was the hottest year globally ever measured. The second hottest was the year before, the third hottest the year before that. And Mother Nature is more persuasive than the scientific community.
Look around, feel it, see it. President Trump saying we're out of the Paris Accord. Of course, people pushed back on that front. Hundreds of demonstrators outside the White House last month protesting that. Yet here, Michael Breen, president and CEO of the Truman National Security Project, a nonprofit in Washington, talking about the consequences of that withdrawal.
This is a decision that cedes the leadership of the 21st century to countries like China, to our economic competitors, that will have no benefit for the American working class and the American economy. Every human being on earth lost today, but no one lost more than the American people.
And you've got people out there saying we may have to take extreme measures to get CO2 out of the atmosphere. This is from a company in Calgary, Canada, Carbon Engineering, it's called. They develop CO2 extraction technology. And this is Jeffrey Holmes, a research scientist there, describing the machinery being used to extract CO2. This is an ad released a couple of years ago.
Now, we'd open this up for a look inside, but we're capturing CO2 with it right now. And by the time we get to the outlet here, where these fans pull the air through the contactor, over 80% of the CO2 has been removed. We're trapping over 100 kilos of CO2 here every day, and that CO2 gets absorbed into our solution and forms a type of carbonate salt.
Okay, fans pulling all that air through, trying to take out that tiny amount of CO2, which turns out is so lethal to the climate as it has ticked up. Omar in Savannah, Georgia, thank you for calling, Omar. You're on with Jim Hansen and John Niles.
Hello. I read a book recently that had a shocking statistic that on average in the United States, we lose to development and deforestation, roads, put it all together, the equivalent square mileage of the state of Delaware. And based on...
Are you saying every year or what? Every year was the claim?
Every year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, couple that with what's happening in other parts of the world, which is even more dramatic. Is this, unfortunately, not a losing battle? Because here, for instance, they did a study on the canopy, and they put data loggers north of a certain street, and the temperatures and air quality were better north of that, and where the city's been clear-cut south of that, It was, you know, 7-8 degrees hotter.
Yep.
And so we all know what the canopy does, but is this not, in fact, a losing battle based on the development in the world?
Jim Hansen?
It doesn't need to be a losing battle. Well, we will have to control population eventually, but in fact, there has been regrowth in many areas because there are more people moving to cities. But it doesn't need to be. We should not give up. But we do have to have – we do have to let nature exist. We do need to restore some forests in marginal lands.
We have to cut the population or population growth. Like how much? By when?
Well, you know, those countries which have become more wealthy, the fertility rate has declined to the replenishment level or even below in some of them. So if we can eliminate poverty, and we have made progress in that direction in the last few decades, then I think it's possible that we can that global population could peak and even begin to come down.
But developed nations are also the biggest consumers of energy. So doesn't it cut both ways? As you eliminate poverty, people want an automobile.
Well, people do like the having an individual vehicle, but it doesn't need to be a fossil fuel powered vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
What we have – energy is needed for our modern society. People like to travel. They like to go to different places in the world, and I don't think we can stop that. But I think we should do it in ways that don't cause the climate change. And we can do that, but only if we make fossil fuels pay their cost to society so we can begin to phase them out and go to clean energies.
Bryce in Detroit. Bryce, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question for your panel. I've read multiple articles that the permafrost in the tundra in the north is melting at an alarming rate, and that is releasing more CO2 in the atmosphere than a lot of the cars that we drive today. My question is, can we stop that? And if so, how do we avoid these massive sinkholes that are coming out of these permafrost melts?
Jim Hansen, how about it? We saw in Antarctica, we saw that huge chunk, breaking off there. You look at the tundra in the north, vast. I've spent a lot of time working on that. If that starts to thaw, there's a big release of CO2 there. You hear our caller's concern that also races ahead of our capacity to control.
Yeah, we can control that by stopping the global warming. That in our paper, the scenarios that we look at, the reason we need to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere is we can begin to slightly cool the planet. You know, what we show is by the end of the century, before the end of the century, it could begin to go down. This all went back to a paper in 2008 where I managed to guess the top experts in paleoclimate relevant subjects. We asked the question, target CO2. What does humanity need to aim for? Because Bill McKibben had told me he was going to form an organization called 450.org.
350, and, I think. Not 450, but 350, right?
No, he said 450.
Oh.
And that's when I said, hold on, our research is showing 450 is too much.
Uh-huh.
450 means that you would be warmer than the Eemian. Eemian had sea level 20 to 30 feet higher than
the Eemian is a period.
That's a period 120,000 years ago, the last time it was warmer than the present interglacial period.
Mm-hmm.
So what we concluded in that paper was the target should be no more than 350 ppm, and it may need to be even somewhat less than that. But if we do that, and we could do it, if we phase down emissions, and that's what the lawsuit is about. We're asking the government to have a plan to phase down emissions at a rate that would be consistent with getting back to 350 ppm within
parts
a century.
Million. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Canada would stop warming. This issue about tundra releasing CO2, we would solve that problem. But
there must be an awful lot of that thaw baked in the cake already of the heating that we've already seen.
Well, there is more baked in the sense that the planet is now out of energy balance. There's more energy coming in from the sun than there is heat being radiated, and that's because of the CO2. But if we reduce the CO2 back to the level that stabilizes the planet's energy balance, then you stop further warming. And we could even go further and take it down a little lower and get some cooling to keep us close to the range in the Holocene, which is the present period, the last 10,000 years, in which sea level has been stable. But now our temperature has actually risen out of the level of the Holocene, the pre-industrial level of the Holocene. And that's why we need to actually reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Life can be tough, but we've had it pretty good in the Holocene when you compare it to alternatives. John in Savannah, Georgia. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question had to do with the fact that the majority of the fossil fuels that we have access to are between 50 and 150 million years old, if I'm correct in that. And so all the carbon that's trapped there was taken out of the atmosphere at that point and trapped in those reserves.
Yep. Yep.
And so that gave the ability for the climate to change the way it has and become the climate that we now see in the Holocene.
Yep.
And so would that not mean that you wouldn't be able to naturally reclaim all of that carbon because the absence of that carbon is what allowed the climate to change in the way that it has to bring about our climate as it is?
So some kind of fundamental primordial balance here that you can't get around? John Niles, is there an inescapable equation here?
There is. I mean, the bottom line is whether we dig up hydrocarbons or sugars or carbohydrates that are in forests, we're pumping 40 billion tons of CO2, which we know heats the world, into the atmosphere every year. So that's the imbalance that Jim talks about and your caller talks about. We need to drive that number way down. And just to give you a little perspective, if we hit 2 degrees warming, which is what will happen if we even do the most aggressive solutions right now, that's still like a human having a sustained temperature of, 102.2 fever. If we get to 4 degrees, Tom, which is very possible given our slow response to this, that's a human temperature equivalent of about 106 degrees. So these are very serious challenges.
Kind of temperature,
no, not if you pump 40 billion tons of heat warming, of earth warming gases into the atmosphere every year.
I'm still trying to see exactly where this CO2 removal would come from. That's a lot of forest. That's a lot of soil treated just so. People talking about a mechanical extraction of CO2, but that's kind of an overwhelming prospect. Moshe is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Moshe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to provide an engineer perspective.
Okay.
Pumping CO2 directly from the atmosphere doesn't make any sense. The concentration is only 400 parts per million. You will need to pump and to filter a lot of air. And for this pumping, you will need a lot of energy.
Yes.
And for this energy, you will emit a lot of CO2. But it doesn't make any sense. It makes sense to capture CO2 from power plant where the concentration is at least 10,000 ppm. About another point about seeding the ocean with iron,
yes.
Your guest failed to say that seeding the ocean with iron would increase drastically plant cone productivity and the ocean fertility.
And is that a problem? Is that a problem?
Well, some say that it's a problem. I look at this as a blessing. Most of the ocean around the world are desert. And more plant corn, you will have more biodiversity, more fish, and it's great. It's great for everybody. So it's a win-win proposition.
Moshe, I really appreciate your calling. First, on that front, are we going to have super fertile oceans, John Niles, if you start scattering iron filings everywhere?
Tom, let me be clear. These types of solutions where we want to actively engineer the Earth's carbon balance by doing these things is not a good solution. The most obvious thing is to stop deforestation and to cut down on fossil fuels. So these are fairly still fantasy science solutions, and they should probably remain in that realm so that we just get our emissions down right now. That's really the point.
But we've been pushed here by our failures so far to collectively take the steps that are necessary, and now we're having to imagine kind of what you call fantasy science. But I mean, Jim's written a whole paper around it. What about, is there some way, is there any conceivable way that you could muster the energy to filter all this air for CO2 without, as our caller Moshe says, just using up so much more energy that you're actually end up polluting more than you pull out of the atmosphere?
Not right now. Nope.
Pretty wild.
Can't do it.
Pretty wild. One more call. Sue in Willsboro, New York. Sue, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Well, in the realm of reality and what's in front of us, I would like to deliver a little message about empowering the everyday citizens that are listening.
Yes, please.
Along with myself.
Yes.
And that is that we can all sequester soil starting to sequester, which means putting the carbon dioxide back in the soil.
Yeah.
You can start today. Plant perennials. Get rid of that lawn that you mow because it has very short roots and it does not hold any carbon dioxide. Instead, plant a beautiful garden, get tall, ornamental, beautiful grasses that have deep roots, and they will sequester the soil. The other benefit is that that empowers people, and once they're empowered to do something about it on a one-to-one basis, they will then care enough about these global technological issues that have been mentioned all morning, which are important. But it's something everyone can do, and it spreads. Once you have a garden, somebody else says, hey, that's a good idea, and you say, yeah, it's wonderful, and you know what? I'm sequestering carbon.
Sue, I love your attitude. Empower us all the way. I really appreciate you calling in with that. Jim Hansen, are you going to empower this lawsuit to force the U.S. to change its policies with your latest study?
Well, I think our Constitution gives rights to young people, and I think the courts are going to force the other branches of government to begin to do their job.
Not to put the young people's futures in hock. Jim Hansen at Columbia University's Earth Institute, great to have you. Thank you for joining us today, Jim.
Sure. Glad to be here.
And John Niles at the Carbon Institute with us today from San Diego, California. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Be empowered. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, a new politics and history podcast from WBUR.
Hey, thanks for sticking around for this preview from our show. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to Freak Out and Carry On wherever you get your podcasts.
Take a listen to this excerpt. Let's welcome our guest, Nick Ameli, director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. Welcome, Nico.
It's great to be here.
So, Nico, there's a widely accepted narrative that the media enabled Trump during his rise, during his campaign and his victory. But also, haven't they been enabling him during those first 100 days? Tell me what the evidence shows as to how Trump has been signing up the media as his handmaiden.
So we've done 5 studies, all of 2015, 2016, and the first 100 days of Trump, looking at media coverage, mainstream major media coverage of Trump, everything from Fox News, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, et cetera. The truth is the media during the campaign overwhelmingly gave Trump positive coverage. Mm. However, one of the reasons for that is that a lot of the stories were driven by polling. And the story was always that Trump was rising in the polls.
The new CNN ORC polls very much about Donald Trump's huge lead as the choice of Republicans for the presidential nomination.
Despite all kind of conventional wisdom to the contrary, he was winning. And it won in the primaries. And so that favors Trump in a really overwhelmingly dramatic way.
However, how about the first 100 days?
In the first 100 days, the coverage is overwhelmingly negative. However, most of the time in the first 100 days, the only person that the media quotes on Trump is Trump. I think it's 6% of the time they quote a Democrat, 4% of the time a congressional Republican, almost no policy experts. The stories about Trump, quote Trump. And so it's a very weird dynamic in that sense. It is overwhelmingly negative, but it's also all Trump all the time.
It's a reality show. They're going to the star.
Compared to the last three presidents, he dominates news coverage. So much more of the nightly newscast is about Trump than in the first 100 days than any prior president. It's really astonishing, almost to the exclusion of all other news.
I mean, he's
like, I'm talking about sports news and weather news. Like, he crushes it.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Is somebody mentioned sports news. I'll just mention this. Is that years ago, an ABC producer, I stuff for Ted Koppel, said, why do people watch sports on television? I said, well, I don't know. It's neatly lined. They're winners and losers. No. It's the only thing that occurs on television. It actually happens. Everything else is produced. Trump occurs on television. You can't take your eyes off of him.
In the 2 years of the presidential campaign, it doesn't matter which candidate or which issue. Pick any candidate, and Trump is quoted 2 to 3 times more in an article about that candidate than the candidate themselves.
Good God.
Trump is quoted more on Ted Cruz than Ted Cruz is. Trump is quoted more on Hillary Clinton than Hillary Clinton.
He had the best lines. Lying Ted, crooked Hillary, low energy Jeb. I mean, you know, you can't not credit a kind of twisted genius in managing that. He hung that around their neck in bully fashion. That's your name now.
I think a crucial question for the media is how they will cover the presidential campaign in 2020. Will they do anything differently?
Well, the problem is if you are either covering Trump or covering the resistance to Trump, he is still defining the narrative.
That's right.